This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
This is the Voice of Freedom. You're listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening once again to the Hour of the Time, the only hour that ever was or that ever will be. This is the most important hour in your life. For during this hour, you will decide your future, and thus our collective futures. Tonight, once again, we will delve into the lost light, the lost word, as it's called, the great plan, the great work, the actual dogma, if you will, the actual true religion of the mysteries, the fraternal orders, the secret societies, which at the pinnacle of their pyramidal process of initiation lie the true and complete body of adepts, those known as the philosophers of fire, the illumined ones, or Illuminati. In the works that I will quote from, you will hear reference to the Illuminati from time to time. And when they mention the Illuminati, they are talking about their brothers or their superiors, the body of wise men whom are working behind the veil, behind the scenes, if you will, the thousand points of light to bring about a utopian socialist world order. I would advise you not to believe anything that you hear on this broadcast or any other broadcast for that matter, but to listen to everyone, read everything, believe absolutely nothing unless you can prove it in your own research. I also advise you to have pen and paper by your side, ladies and gentlemen, so you can take notes copiously if you expect to retain and understand, ultimately, any of what you are going to hear this evening. And for those of you who may have an inkling based upon your past study of our Mystery Babylon broadcasts, you will find great treasure. And I don't mean the kind of treasure that will cause you to switch religions or cause some dawning of some great truth to manifest itself in your mind, but will cause you a tremendous leap in understanding about where we are and where we're going, who is at the helm, and why they hate. And when I say hate, ladies and gentlemen, I am not mincing words. Why they hate you with a passion. I remind the listeners to this broadcast that this is not a religious broadcast. It is an illumination. A great man once said, "Seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free." And so, with this series, I bring you the truth of a great secret in the world. At work, constantly, all the time, only you, the profane, not understanding the language of this hidden work, this hidden manipulation, this great plan, stumble blindly through the forest, bouncing off of the trees. You don't know where you're going, you don't know where you came from, and you have no idea why you are where you are at. The Western world has too long and fatuously labored under the delusion that a pious and devout disposition fulfills the whole requirement of true religion. Now, this is the belief of those who belong to the mystery religion of ancient Babylon, and that's exactly where this comes from. And you must understand that I am quoting from esoteric works that you will not find in your local library, and I will be quoting from several of those works tonight. Ancient sagacity knew that piety without intelligence or religion without philosophy was insufficient and dangerous. It knew that general good intent was not safe from aberrancy, folly, and fanaticism, unless it was directed by the highest powers and resources of the mind. And the mind itself had to be fortified with specific knowledge of the nature of the cosmos and of man, and the relation between the two. Following the dictum of the sage Hermes Trismegistus, that, quote, "the vice of a soul is ignorance, the virtue of a soul is knowledge," end quote, the scriptures of old inculcated the precept that with all man's getting, he must first get wisdom and understanding. These were related to his well-being as health to his navel and marrow to his bones, and would alone give him a crown of eternal life. They were pronounced more precious than all the things that he could desire. The Council of Illuminati therefore laid down their system of cosmology and anthropology, which have become by immemorial tradition the Bibles of humanity, universally reverenced. In them were given the ordinances of life, the constitution of the cosmos, the laws governing both nature and mind. They still constitute the Magna Carta of all human action guided by intelligence, for they were the first institutes embodying the principia and fundamenta of all moral behavior, the only true chart and compass to guide human effort in a line of harmony with an overshadowing divine plan of evolution for the cosmos. The corruption and final loss of the basic meaning of these scriptures has been, in the whole of time, the greatest tragedy in human history. Like Shakespeare's Tide, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune, but omitted, casts all the rest of life in shoals and quicksands, the wreckage of the esoteric gnosis in the centuries following Plato's day, culminating in the debacle of all philosophical religion about the third century of Christianity's development and ushering in 16 centuries of the Dark Ages, has thrown all religion out of basic relation to true understanding and caused it to breed an endless train of evils, fanaticisms, bigotries, idiosyncrasies, superstitions, wars, and persecutions that more than anything else blacken the record of man's historic struggle toward the light. The present, most frightful of all historical barbarities, owes its incidence directly to the decay of ancient philosophical knowledge and the loss of vision and virtue that would have attended its perpetuation. What, then, must be the importance of a book which restores to the scriptures of ancient wisdom the lost light of their true, original meaning? Well, in a very real and direct way, the salvation of culture and a free spirit in the world is contingent upon this restoration of the ancient intelligence to modernity. For man at this age has had new and mighty powers of nature suddenly placed in his hands, and yet lacks the spiritual poise and sagacity to use them without calamity. Most strangely, the control of the lower physical, natural, or brute forces by the mind or reason was the one central situation primarily and fundamentally dealt with in the sage tones of antiquity. To effect that control in a perfect balance and harmony, and to train the reasoning intellect in the divine art of it, was the aim and end of the arcane philosophy. Ideology in the Western world has endlessly vacillated back and forth between the cult of the inner spirit and engrossment in objective materialism. Ancient philosophy taught that the true path of evolutionary growth was to be trodden by an effort that united the forces of the spirit with those of the world, the lower disciplined by the higher. The whole gist of the esoteric doctrine was the study and mastery of the powers engaged in working out the evolutionary advance so that the aspirant might be able to align his cultural effort in consonance with the requirements of the problem and the end to be achieved. Now, without this guiding data and this evolutionary perspective, modern man is totally at a loss how to focus his endeavor and is unable to point his direction in line with anything more fixed and basic than his next immediate objective of apparent desirability. He has neither a knowledge of his origin, a chart of his path, an inventory of his capacities, or a vision of his goal. Hence, he travels the long road, still a benighted wanderer without compass. He can but recoil from one mistaken plunge after another, learning sporadic lessons from pain and misfortune. The ancient torch that was lighted for his guidance, he has let burn out. This lamp was the body of ancient philosophy, in this critical epoch in the life of the world, this broadcast proclaims afresh the message of lost truth according to the adepts, the Illuminati, of the secret doctrine of the mystery religion of ancient Babylon. Now don't mistake what you hear on this broadcast for what I believe, ladies and gentlemen. That is not the purpose of the broadcast. And I can assure you that most of this, other than the fact that it is the truth of what the worshipers of this religion believe, I do not believe at all, I can assure you. Three ancient and long discredited sciences have had a surprising renaissance in popular fancy and scientific interest. You have heard it from me many times. One is symbolism, one is alchemy, another is astrology. The last has particularly come into a general vogue, but on a basis which still inclines conservative positivism in science and scholarship to regard it as allied closely with popular superstition. In its predictive or fortune-telling aspect, it is generally looked at askance. But there is another side on which it has pertinence and value that has not been recognized in the modern revival, and on which perhaps its most legitimate claim to consideration may rest. This is its function as symbolic theology. And in that manner, ladies and gentlemen, you can take it to the bank, but only if you understand the symbology. Unquestionably, according to the great adept's cosmic operation, cosmic significance lie behind the 12 constellations of the zodiac and the 36 or more other stellar configurations. The planisphere, or chart of the heavens, was doubtless the very first of all Bibles, pictorially edited, not quite simply and directly, but intrinsically. All Bibles are amplifications and elaborations of the original volume of ideography first written on the open face of the sky, charted in the zodiac, and heavenly maps, and later transferred to earth and written in scrolls and parchments. It came about when man could not write, when man wished to express his feelings about life, about spirituality, about his origins, about the truths of life as he understood it, about his basic philosophy. And so not being able to put it down on paper or to etch it in stone in those early times, he outlined it in the heavens using the stars that floated above him, rising in the east and setting in the west. Night after night after night, eon after eon, thousands of years. Passed down by word of mouth, and then one day, etched in stone, transferred to paper, and then finally printed in a book. Man was instructed to fashion his new body of spiritual glory after the pattern of things in the heavens, the heavenly or zodiacal man, and a graph of the structure and history of this celestial personage was sketched by the enlightened sages in the configurated star clusters. Zodiac, you see, comes from the Greek word zodion, a small living image, signifying that it is a graph of the microcosmic life of man, which is cast in the form of the macrocosmic life of the universe, or, to put it in a manner that you may understand more readily, or of God. Man's own small body is a replica of this body of God, made in its image and likeness. And isn't that what the Bible tells us? The vast frame of cosmic man was outlined in the scroll of the heavens, the solar systems and galaxies being living cell clusters in his immense organism. A great deal of this adumbrated symbology, elucidating theological doctrinism, is set forth in the body of the series of broadcasts, which will be presented to you over the coming nights and weeks, and it will take weeks. But there is a group of its data that strikes so deeply into the heart of general theology that it is given tonight, during this broadcast, right at the outset, for the sake of its overwhelming impressiveness. And it will also help you to understand all that follows. It must prove to be so conclusive an evidence that biblical theology rests more solidly than has ever been believed on zodiacal backgrounds that its presentation will be admittedly a matter of great moment for those who can grasp it. It traces the unsuspected significance of two of the 12 signs, Virgo and Pisces, in the very heart of New Testament narrative. Now let the reader picture before him the ordinary zodiac with the house of Virgo at the western equinox point and that of Pisces directly opposite on the eastern side. The simple fact that they stand 6 months apart will presently be seen to assume great importance in gospel determination. This exposition, ladies and gentlemen, must begin with the puzzling and hitherto unexplained item of ancient religious myth that the Christs, the Son, spelled S-U-N, gods, the Messiahs, all were depicted as having two mothers. Now how... How, you ask, could there possibly be rational significance in this? Well, it has been put aside as just some more of the mythical rubbish and nonsense of early paganism. You see, the profundity of pagan intelligence hiding sublime cosmic truth under glyph and symbol has not been dreamed of by the vast majority, and I mean majority down to almost the nth in degree, of all of the people who have ever lived who have not been indoctrinated into this religion through the pyramidal system of initiation. The depiction should not have created incredulity, seeing that the gospel Jesus himself, dramatic figure of the divine principle in man, announced it categorically in declaring to Nicodemus that, quote, ye must be born again, end quote. Born again signifies two births. Two births means two mothers. Nicodemus asks if this means that we must enter a second time into our mother's body and experience a second birth in the natural manner. Jesus replies that we, quote, must be born of water and the Spirit, end quote. Attention, ladies and gentlemen, must be directed a moment to the fact that the Latin word spiritus, translated spirit in many passages, means as well air or breath. One of the great keys to Bible meaning is the series of the four elements of ancient mythicism: earth, water, air, and fire. The body of the physical, or natural man, was conceived as being composed of the two lower, earth and water, while air and fire, representing mind and spirit, commingled to make the higher or spiritual man. Jesus' statement to Nicodemus, then, could have been rendered born of water and air. And John the Baptist uses three of the four elements when he states that he, the forerunner of the Christos, and therefore a type of the lower natural man, indeed baptizes us with water, omitting earth, but that there cometh after him one higher than himself, who shall baptize us with the Holy Spiritus, air, and with fire. Jesus thus affirms that we have two births, necessitating two mothers, and John the Baptist adds that we must have two baptisms. Since man's spirit is an indestructible fragment of God's own mighty spirit, truly a tiny spark of that cosmic intelligence and love, which we call the mind of God, the ancients typified the divine element in man by fire, and in contrast, the lower, or human element, by water. The fiery soul of man, according to the adepts, is housed in a tenement of flesh and matter, which is 7/8 water by actual composition. The crossing of rivers and seas, and the immersion of solar heroes in water in olden mythologies, and the rite of baptism in theology, signified nothing beyond the fact of the soul's immersion in a physical body of watery nature in its successive incarnations. One of the prime tenets of the mystery schools is reincarnation. Now, once you understand thus far, now man is distinctly a creature compounded of two natures, a higher and a lower, a spiritual and a sensual, a divine and a human, a mortal and an immortal, and finally, a fiery and a watery, conjoined in a mutual relationship in the organic body of flesh. Says Heraclitus, man is a portion of cosmic fire, imprisoned in a body of earth and water. Speaking of man, Plato affirms, through body it is an animal, through intellect it is a god. To create man, God incarnated the fiery spiritual principle of his life in the watery confines of material bodies. That is the truest basic description of man that anthropology can present. All problems spring from that foundation and are referable for solution back to it. And in past programs, we talked about this principle in the attempt to cast the molten sea. So man is then a natural man and a god in combination, according to this mystery religion. Our natural body gives the soul of man its baptism by water. Our nascent spiritual body is to give us the later baptism by fire. We are born first as the natural man, then as the spiritual, or we are born first by water and then by fire. Of vital significance at this point are two statements by St. Paul. Quote, that was not the first which is spiritual, but that which is natural. And first that which is natural, then that which is spiritual, end quote. And again he says, quote, for the natural man comprehendeth not the things of the Spirit of God, neither can he, end quote. Of course not. For he is not yet in that higher kingdom of evolution, and he must be transformed, transfigured, lifted up into a superior world of consciousness before he can cognize spiritual things. And evolution, they believe, will thus transform him, and nothing else will. So using astrological bases for portraying cosmic truths according to the adepts, the ancients localized the birth of the natural man in the zodiacal house of Virgo, and that of the spiritual man in the opposite house of Pisces. These then were the houses of the two mothers of life. The first was the Virgin Mother, Virgo, the primeval symbol of the Virgin Mary, thousands of years B.C. I repeat, thousands of years B.C. Virgo gave man his natural birth by water and became known as the Water Mother. Pisces, on the other hand, the fishes by name, gave him his birth by the fish and was denominated the Fish Mother. The Virgin Mothers are all identified with water as symbol, and their various names, such as Mary, spelled M-E-R-I, Mary, spelled M-A-R-Y, Venus, V-E-N-U-S, which literally means born of the sea foam, Tiamat, Typhon, are Thala, all Greek for sea, are designations for water. On the other side, there are the fish avatars of Vishnu, such as the Babylonian Iones, or Dagon, and the Assyrian goddess, Atargatis, was called the fish mother. Virgo stood as the mother of birth by water, or the birth of man, the first of the earth, earthy. Pisces stood as the mother of birth by spirit or fire, or the birth of man, the second, described by St. Paul as, quote, the Lord from heaven, end quote. Remember, I told you on many, many broadcasts ago that Paul was a member of the mystery schools. There's no doubt about it. Anyone who has studied the symbology and the teachings of the mysteries can read the life of Paul and the letters and see scattered all throughout this secret doctrine. Virgo was the water mother of the natural man. Pisces, the fish mother of the spiritual man. So there must now be brought out an proceeds in and from water. All first life originated in the seawater according to the theory of evolution, and these people are the ones who brought that about. The fish is a birth in and from the water, and it stands patiently, patently, as the generic type of organic life issuing out of inorganic. The fish typifies life embodied in a physical organic structure. Organic life is born out of the water and is the first birth, child of the water mother. And if organic life is in turn to become mother, its child will be mind and spiritual consciousness, son of the fish mother. In brief, water is the mother of natural physical being, and organic structure becomes the later mother of divine mind. Now, strangely enough, water is the type of another thing which is still more germinal of life, namely, matter. You see, matter is the virgin mother of all life in the aboriginal Genesis. All things are generated in the womb of primordial matter, the old genetrix of Egyptian mythology, and it is by a consideration of the nature of matter and its evolution that we are enabled to arrive at last at the true meaning of the double motherhood of life. For oddly enough, matter is seen to exist in two states, in each of which it becomes mother of life at two different levels. According to the mysteries, primordial matter, the sea of, to us, empty space, is the first mother of all living forms. This is the primal abyss of the waters in Genesis. The Latin word for mother is our very word mater, with one T left out, spelled M-A-T-E-R. And how close to M-A-T-E-R is water, and organic structure is the second mother, parent of spiritual mind. The ancient books always grouped the two mothers in pairs. They were called the two mothers, or sometimes the two divine sisters, or they were the wife and sister of the god under the names of Juno, Isis, Ishtar, Sibyl, or Mileta. In Old Egypt, they were first Apt and Neith, and later Isis and Nephthys. Massey relates Neith to net, in effect, fishnet. Clues to their functions were picked up in the great Book of the Dead. Quote, Isis conceived him, Nephthys gave him birth, end quote. Or, quote, Isis bore him, Nephthys suckled him, end quote, or reared him. Now, the full sense of these statements was not discerned until they were scrutinized in the light of another key sentence which matched them. Quote, "Heaven conceived him, the Tuat brought him forth," end quote. With this came the flash of clear insight into the mystery. For that which is to eventuate in the cycles of evolution as divine mind and an organic creature, man, is aboriginally conceived by divine ideation in the innermost depths of cosmic consciousness, or in the purely noumenal world, or again, in the bosom of infinite spirit, where spirit is identical with pure, undifferentiated matter. This is mirrored in the Egyptian statement that Isis conceived him. Matter, in its invisible, inorganic state, was the womb of the first conception. You see, Isis is a virgin, in effect pure matter, or matter sublimated to spiritual tenuity. The Tuat, on the other hand, is really earth, as the type of physical matter, or matter organic, aggregated into substantial forms called by us physical matter. It is matter as substance, constituted and existent in the visible world in structural forms. Isis was matter subsistent as empty space, and Nephthys was atomic matter constituent of visible structural forms. The physical world, which we must now think of as floating in the sea of empty space, like fish in the water, are the second form of matter, and their organic bodies of substantial matter give birth to the Logoi in the solar systems and to the Christos in man. This is another one of their basic tenets, that there is a Christ in every man. So divine spirit is conceived in the womb of Isis, the first universal mother, and brought to birth in the womb of Nephthys, the second mother. The immediate incubator and gestator is manifest expression. Now, one might paraphrase this situation by saying that a human child is first conceived in the love or mind of its parents and later born from the womb of its physical mother. Thus, life has two births and must of necessity have two mothers. Life is spiritually conceived and materially born. Or, man may be said to be born as a natural creature from spirit into matter, and born later as a spiritual god when he emerges from his baptism in the water of the body and re-enters the bosom of his father. Or finally, he is born first as man by water, and reborn later as God by fire. And the first birth was depicted as taking place on the western side of the zodiac in the house or womb of the Virgin Mother, Virgo. Because in the west, the sun, universal symbol of spiritual fire, descended into organic matter in its setting or incarnation. So man is born as natural man on the west, to be regenerated as spiritual man on the east after having traveled through the underworld. Spirit's descent on the west makes it man. Its resurrection on the east, like the summer sunrise, makes it deity again. It was a great misconception, ladies and gentlemen. This is from my own knowledge and scattered throughout this teaching is my own knowledge. It was a great mistake for those who discovered the Egyptian Book of the Dead to believe that it was about the dead. In fact, it is the map of the journey of the soul according to the ancient mystery religions. As the soul descended into matter, into water, it died. It suffered a death. It journeyed through the underworld here on this earth, living in a human body in what they called Amenta, or hell. And then the soul was reborn again. First, it was died in the body, but the body was born a living human being. And then when the body died, the soul was reborn and ascended again to unite with God and get ready for another incarnation. And during each incarnation, the soul suffered two deaths and two births from two mothers and gained experience and knowledge and wisdom through its life, usually signified by a three-day period in Amenta or hell, which was and still is in the mysteries this earth. The soul could die in this process and not regain reunion with its father or the whole simply by allowing the base nature of the animal in man to take over and rule or conquer the soul. That is why in ancient times, if one wished to become more spiritual, one would voluntarily have himself, or do it himself, neuter. And this was normally only done with males. I don't know of any instances where females neutered themselves, but it was common practice for those who considered themselves to be of the spiritual realm to castrate themselves. And so we take a little pause here so that I can have a drink of water. So just to recap a little, spirit's descent on the west makes it man. Its resurrection on the east like the summer sunrise makes it deity again. You see, they believe that all things stem from the one thing which was all that there was in the beginning. And that even rocks and trees and dirt and water and meteorites and water faucets all have a spark of divinity within them. And that they all have a chance in the next life to rise above that stage of evolution or reincarnation, which is a form of evolution, into a higher form and eventually, if they learn the proper lessons, will become a permanent part, residing always with God. At that point, they become an ascended master and can, according to the Illuminati, come back down to this earth to help humanity in its evolution as gods. Literally, they believe, as gods. This is the death and resurrection of the God in all religions. It is incarnation and return to spirit. It is the descent of the Messiah into Egypt and his exodus back to Canaan. A further scrutiny, ladies and gentlemen, of such data brings to light links of connection with the Bible. You can't get away from it. It's there. The chief one is found in the symbol of bread in connection with both Virgo and Pisces. Pisces is the house of the fishes by name, but it is not commonly known that Virgo, in astrological symbology, was the house of bread. Now, this is indicated by several items of ancient typology. Many centuries ago, in the precession of the equinoxes, the end of the year was marked by the position of the great dog star Sirius, mighty celestial symbol of the divinity in man. Precisely at midnight of December the 24th, it stood on the meridian line from the zenith to Egypt. At the same moment, there arose on the eastern horizon the constellation of the Virgin, bearing in her left arm the Christ child, symbol of the Christhood coming to function in man, and in her right hand the great star Spica, which is Latin, a head or spike of wheat, symbol of that same divinity coming as celestial food for man, food for the Spirit. It must ever be remembered that the Gospel Jesus told us we had virtually to eat his body as food and drink his blood if we would inherit eternal life. So typism represented him as coming in the form of man, the babe Christ, and as food for man, the wheat. John speaks of the Christ principle in the words, quote, "This is that bread which came down from heaven, that if a man eat of it, he shall hunger no more," end quote. Check it out. Jesus broke a loaf into fragments and gave to his disciples, saying that it was his body broken for them. So we now have Virgo established as the house of bread and Pisces as the house of fish. But the characterization of the two houses must be brought along to a more specific evolutionary reverence. And, of course, you must have it as a positive reference. What are these houses thus delineated? They are, as at first, the two states of matter, but now to be taken in immediate reference to the life of man on earth. They are in the final stage of the meaning man's body itself, which consists of matter in both its invisible and its visible forms. For man has a natural body, and a spiritual body. Man's body itself houses the two mothers. The body is this double house of bread and of fish. And the next link is seen when it is considered that this physical body is for the soul, the house of death, and in its regenerative phase, the house of rebirth. It is the house into which the spirit descends to its partial obscuration in the darkness of the grave of matter, into the night of death or incarnation, out of which it is to arise in a new birth or resurrection on the opposite side of the cycle. A significant passage from the Book of the Dead recites, quote, "Who cometh forth from the dust, and whose birth is in the house of death," end quote, referring to the incarnating soul. In a spiritual sense, the soul dies on entering the body in incarnation, but has a new birth in it as it later resurrects from it. The body is therefore the house of his death and rebirth, or the place of his crucifixion and resurrection. It is the coffin. And in the initiatory rites of the secret fraternal orders, the initiate lies down in a coffin and suffers a symbolic death. He is then raised with the grip of the lion's paw, given a new name and a new life. The body is therefore the house of his death and rebirth, or the place of his crucifixion and resurrection. And the Egyptians had a name for the body as the locus of these transformations, which carry the central meaning of all theologies. This name now rises out of the dim mists of ancient Egyptian books to enlighten all modern Bible comprehension. This city of the body, where the Sun of Soul, spelled S-U-N, of soul, sank to its death on the cross of matter to re-arise in a new birth was called the city of the sun, or in Greek, Heliopolis, but in the Egyptian, Anu. The name was given to an actual Egyptian city where the rites of the death, burial, and resurrection of Osiris or Horus were enacted each year, but the name bore a theological significance before it was given to a geographical town. The name is obviously made up of Nu, spelled N-U. The name for the mother heaven, or empty space, or abyss of nothingness, and Alpha, privative meaning as in thousands of words, not. Anu would then mean not nothingness, or a world of concrete actuality, the world of physical, substantial manifestation. Precisely such a world it is in which units of virginal consciousness go to their death and then rise again. Anu is then the physical body of man on earth. The soul descends out of the waters of the abyss of the nun, or space in its undifferentiated unity, which is the sign and name of all things negative. The nun, spelled N-U-N, is indeed our nun, spelled N-O-N-E. Life, in the completeness of its unity, is negative. To become positively manifest, it must differentiate itself into duality, establish positive-negative tension, and later split up into untold multiplicity. This brings out the significance of the biblical word multiply. You see, life cannot manifest itself in concrete forms until it multiplies itself endlessly. Unit life of deity must break itself up into infinite fragments in order to fill empty space with a multitude of worlds and beings of different natures. The primal sea, or mother, or Mary, must engender a multitudinous progeny to spawn the limitless shoals of organic fish worlds. And this is the meaning of the promise given to Abraham that his seed should multiply till it filled the earth with offspring countless as the sands of the seashore. And if life was symboled by bread as the first birth and by fish as the second, then we might expect to find in old religious typology the allegory of a Christ figure multiplying loaves and fishes. Are you surprised to find that the gospel Jesus does this very thing, multiplying the five loaves and two small fishes to feed a multitude? This is absolutely astonishing, in all conscience. But it yields in wonder to the next datum of comparative religion, which came to our notice as a further tie between the Bible and antecedent Egyptian mythology. Who can adequately measure the seriousness of the challenge which this item of scholarship presents to gospel historicity? For a discovery of sensational interest came to light when a passage was found in the Book of the Dead, which gave to Anu the characteristic designation, the place of multiplying bread. Here, in the long silent tomes of old Egypt, was found the original, the prototype of the miracle of the loaves and the fishes in the Gospels of Christianity, and a meaning never before apprehended had to be read into this New Testament wonder. At last, we were instructed to catch in the middle the miracle, the sense that the physical body, as Anu, was the place where the corpus of the Christ deific power was broken into an infinite number of fragments and distributed out among a multitude of creatures in hungered after a 3 days fast or deprivation of the food of spiritual life in their sojourn in the three kingdoms, the mineral, vegetable, and animal, before reaching the plane of mind. And so there you have the first four races. We, according to the mysteries, are the fifth root race and must move in the new millennium, in the new world, in the new age, into the sixth root race. Here are all the elements of the inner meaning of the Christian Eucharist, the broken but multiplied fragments of the body of the God distributed to feed hungry humanity, and as humanity is composed of 12 groups of divine conscious units, there were gathered up 12 baskets of fragments. And this episode of the Christ's ostensible life is found to be Egyptian in origin and meaning and symbolic in character. But new implications arise and lead us on to more startling disclosures. You see, the Hebrews came along and appropriated Egyptian material during their so-called captivity. They picked up the name Anu, and fitting it back into its zodiacal setting as Virgo, they called it the House of Bread. This required their adding to Anu their word for house, which, as anyone knows, is Beth. This yields us Beth Anu. Now, it is a fact of common philological knowledge that the ancient Greek and Egyptian U is rendered as Y. When the words are brought over into English, the U became a Y, and Beth Anu now stands before us as the Bethany of the Gospels. Bethany is thus just the sign of Virgo as the House of Bread, the home of the great star Spica, the head of wheat. Lechem. Lechem is bread in everyday Hebrew. The Christ was born in Bethany, or Bethlehem, the astrological house of bread. Later, it seems that the two signs, Virgo and Pisces, had their symbols, bread and fish, were almost interchangeably confused or commingled in the symbolic imagery. This was natural, since the two signs represented the same body of man in its two aspects of dying and being reborn, and the two processes are confusedly interblended. And that's where we'll leave off tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We will, again, do this tomorrow night. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you.